confidential knowledge. So now I'm just going to get his explanation. Yes, Chief.
Can I ask a question about something from the past? I don't understand what more confidential knowledge is.
More confidential knowledge is knowledge of the super soul. Confidential knowledge of Brahman. You can do like this: confidential knowledge of Brahman, more confidential knowledge of super soul, most confidential knowledge of Bhagavan. So when you have more and most, that's how you distinguish that. Prabhupada says that in one purport somewhere. I don't think in here he discusses more and most. He just discusses confidential and more, or confidential and most. Okay?
Mm-hmm.
Text number 4, page 457. This section, 4 through 10, explains Krishna's position in relationship to his energies in the material world. His mystical yoga maishvaya, his mystical opulence by which he expands himself for the purpose of creation while remaining beyond it and aloof at the same time. Okay, so that's all through 4 through 10. That's a section. So text 4, we'll read the Sanskrit. Maya tatam idam sarvam.
Maya tatam idam sarvam.
Jagatavyakta muritina.
Jagatavyakta muritina.
Astani sarabhutani.
Astani sarabhutani.
Vachaham teshva vatishta.
Vachaham teshva vastita.
Maya. By me, tatam related idam this sarvam. Cosmic manifestation of Yakta Murtina by the unmanifested form of Stani in me, Sarvabhutani, all living entities. Na, not cha, also, aham, I, teshu, in them, avashtita, situated. Translation. By me, in my unmanifested form, this entire universe is pervaded. All beings are in me, but I am not in them. Let's read it together. My being, my unmanifested form, this entire universe is pervaded.
All beings are in me, but I am not in them.
Srila Prabhupada has put forth. The Supreme Personality of Godhead is not perceivable through the gross material senses. It is said, Tathat Shri Krishna Namadi Nabhavet Krayam Indriyai Sevamukhehi Jivhadao Svayam Ivras Paratyada. That's from the Bhakti Rasamrita Sindhu 1, 2, 2, 3, 4. Lord Shri Krishna's name, fame, pastimes, etc. cannot be understood by material senses. Only to one who is engaged in pure devotional service under proper guidance is he revealed. In the Brahma Samhita 5.38 it is stated, Parimanjana charita bhakti virochani nasanta sadaiva dvareshu virovayanti. One can see the Supreme Personality of Godhead, Govinda, always within himself and outside himself if one has developed the transcendental loving attitude towards him. Thus, for people in general, he's not visible. Here it is said that although he is all-pervading, everywhere present, he is not conceivable by the material senses. This is indicated here by the word of Yakta Murtina. But actually, although we cannot see him, everything is resting in him. As we have discussed in the 7th chapter, the entire material cosmic manifestation is only a combination of his two different energies, the superior spiritual energy and the inferior material energy. Just as the sunshine is spread all over the universe, the energy of the Lord is spread all over the creation. And everything is resting in that energy. Yet one should not conclude that because he is spread all over, he has lost his personal existence. To refute such arguments, the Lord says, I am everywhere, and everything is in me, but still I am aloof. For example, a king heads a government which is but the manifestation of the king's energy. The different governmental departments are nothing but the energies of the king, and each department is resting on the king's power. But still, one cannot expect the king to be present in every department personally. That is a crude example. Similarly, all the manifestations that we see, and everything that exists both in this material world and in the spiritual world, are resting on the energy of the Supreme Personality of Godhead. The creation takes place by the diffusion of his different energies, and is stated in the Bhagavad Gita, Vishtapyam Idam Krishnam. He is everywhere present by his personal representation and diffusion of his different energies. By me, in my unmanifested form, this entire universe is pervaded. All beings are in me, but I am not in them. Prabhupada begins by explaining why the Lord is unmanifest in my avyakta murtina, my unmanifest form. Why is he unmanifest? What does he say? Why is Krishna not manifest?
He's
not perceivable by what? Not material senses. And so, in support of this, Prabhupada quotes two verses. The verse, very importantly, Atat Sri Krishna Namadi Nabhavit Graya Indriyai. These Indriyai, these senses, these material senses, cannot grasp the name Sri Krishna Namadi, Krishna's name, etc. Name, form, attributes, relationships, pastimes, qualities. These transcendental attributes of Krishna, these transcendental qualities, characteristics, they cannot be perceived or grasped by our material senses. This is what Jiva Goswami says. Only, he says, when the senses, jivhadao, the tongue, etc., the tongue and all the other senses, so it begins with the tongue, are engaged in Krishna's service, does everything become revealed. Only those senses that have been purified are being engaged in devotional service, does Krishna become manifest. This is practically one of the charter quotes of devotional service. The object of purifying the senses by engaging in the devotional service, so that by that act Krishna becomes manifest. Because that spiritualizes the senses. When the senses are used in Krishna's service, they're spiritualized. Originally the senses are spiritual. Our eyes, our hands, our legs, our tongue, all those things are actually meant for serving Krishna. And when we divert them to our sinister purpose of enjoying separately from Krishna, then those senses become material and Krishna disappears. He vanishes. So when the same senses are rectified in their purpose by being engaged in Krishna's service, then again Krishna reappears to those senses. So we're engaged in re-spiritualizing our senses back to their original condition of service to Krishna. Then, Primanjana Charita Bhakti Varochanaina Santa Sadaiva Dayeshvalopiyanti. This says that Krishna appears in the heart of those, it says, Primanjana Charita Bhakti Varochanaina, whose eyes have been anointed with the ointment of prema. So our eyes, same purple, these eyes, and they're, now they can't see Krishna. But when they've been anointed by the unguent or salve or ointment of prema, Krishna prema, then they can see Krishna from the love, and they're transformed by love of God. Then those persons can always see Krishna within their own hearts and also outside of themselves. So until that happens, it's not visible. So what he says, although we cannot see him, everything is resting in him. His form may be not manifest to him, but he is pervading this whole creation, and everything is resting. All beings are in me, he says. So everything is resting on him. Dependent upon him for their existence, in the same way that the sunlight is dependent on the sun. So we already saw in sights how we saw in the seventh chapter how this Krishna has two energies. Eight separated material energies, earth, air, fire, water, ether, mind, intelligence, and false ego. And then again that what kind of prakriti is the first one called in the universe? Earth, air, fire, water. Sanskrit word. Both are prakriti. There's two energies. One is one kind of prakriti, and the other is the other kind of prakriti. Can you remember the Sanskrit words? Yeah, para and apara. Apara prakriti. Inferior and para prakriti, superior. So these two prakritis come from Krishna. Combinedly, they make up the whole universe. So they emanate from him. In terms of Western philosophy, or we would say that Krishna is the, there's different kinds of causes, efficient cause, formal cause, final cause, and material cause. This is Aristotle. So Christian philosophy tends to deny that God is the material cause of the world, that it comes out of his, that they call it the material cause, that out of which something is made. So the Christian doctrine is that of creation ex nihilo, of the world is created out of nothing. But what's being taught here, that this is wrong. It's not created out of nothing, but it is expanded from the energies of the Lord. He is the material cause of the creation. And the conventional, at least, I think Thomas Aquinas dealt with this in one of his books, the Summa Contradictus, and he says that God couldn't be the material cause of the creation, because then if he evolved his world out of himself, he would be changed. But there's already, we already understand how that's not at all the implication. As discussed in the beginning of the Kishopanishad, that although some of the complete units emanate from him, he remains complete. So here he says also, all beings are in me, but I am not in them. So he remains aloof at the same time. He hasn't lost his personal existence. The whole universe expands from him. And in a sense, he's everything. But not everything is Krishna. Krishna is aloof. So this is the way we understand. We understand that nothing is different from Krishna. Everything we see is Krishna's energy. Krishna's present in the Atmamurti all over the place. And yet also he's in a transcendent position in Goloka Vrindavan. People who see or claim that God is everywhere, everything is God, are known as pantheists. They worship nature as God. Deus sive nature, natura. Deus sive natura. This is Spinoza. God or nature. Same synonyms for him, nature. And they think that therefore God is fully, what's the word they, imminent. And therefore has lost his, or never has, or is no, has no transcendent status. He's imminent in creation. But this is giving full way to immanence and full way to transcendence. All beings are in me, but I am not in them. And so Prabhupada gives the crude example of the king. In a sense, the king, the energies, the different departments are the energies of the king. When FBI agent comes and arrests you, that be fake, you are arrested by the United States government. By the government itself, then if we are in a more personal situation, you'd actually be arrested by the king. Because the government and the king were the same thing now, so less personal. But it's not that the government itself arrests you, just one agent. The energy of the government. So that's the way it works. Similarly, all the manifestations that we see and everything that exists, both in this material world and the spiritual world, are resting on the energies of the Supreme Personality of Godhead. That's the idea of Prabhupada using the expression, the diffusion of his energy. So any questions about this? Yes?
Well, I don't understand. He says, but I'm not in him. I thought he was. It's super soul.
All beings are in me. A super soul, all beings are in him.
What?
But he is not in them. This means that I'm not situated in them. That simply means that he is not implicated he's just not a being among other beings. And for example, when Super Soul is in my heart, so, but it's not that when I feel heat or cold or pleasure and pain and suffer these things, the Super Soul suffers those things. He's aloof. The super soul is spread out in the hearts of all living entities. At the same time, he's also situated in his own planet called Svetadvipa. He's not in. What it means by not in them means that I'm not undergoing the processes of this material world. He's not affected by the process of this material world. Although everything is resting on him, although in a sense he is everything, still he's not affected by what's happening. That's what it means by in them. So actually, although we speak of the super soul in our heart, actually we are inside the super soul.
Same question.
Same that satisfactory answer? Or?
I'm still confused.
Yeah, okay.
Are we in the super soul because actually the entire universe is a big super soul? Is that how we're in the super soul? Just like within each atom is another.
There is Krishna, right? There's Krishna. And Lady Yashoda looked into his mouth. And she was here, Krishna was there. And she looked into his mouth, looking for a piece of dirt. And in his mouth, she saw the whole cosmic manifestation inside Krishna, including herself looking in Krishna's mouth. So the whole thing, like just turned inside out. It's impossible to conceive. So, but it's Prabhupada, when he discusses this, I am not in them, means that the energies of Krishna are working in a more or less detached and automatic fashion. He talks about separated energies, Krishna separated energies. Prabhupada uses the example of a tape recorder. You listen to a tape recorder of his lecture, that is his separated energy. Another crude example. So it's going on. His energies work automatically. He doesn't have to. And this will be explained later on in these verses 4-10. But Krishna, in order to get these energies to work, they just do it. There's no effort on Krishna's part. When we want to do something, we have to first get the will and the desire and the determination, and then from our determination there are so many sequences and there's an act. Prabhupada says later on in the purport, his determination becomes fact. Just instantly. His will immediately is manifest as fact. So he's not involved. Even though he comes down as the super soul and everything like that, he's in a aloof position from the material energy. I don't know if I can explain it any better than that. Yeah?
The verse of kids, he is not conceivable by material senses. I had a conversation with Martha today. I got an insight out of that. You know, my whole thing has been I was born, okay, and I never really believed in it, and yet I would try to participate in, it's like we were taught, you believe first, because you have to believe first, and then you take what would be the process. Now, it says that he is not seen by the material senses, so, as Missy Martha said, Peter Shannon's got more real to you now than before. She said, yes. Now, when I look at myself, I guess, how could I, because you're God, define all I'm operating on now on my material senses? Mm-hmm. So it's like, without the process, it's like backwards from what I have always come to believe in. Like, it's through the process will facilitate this awareness of God.
That's right.
And I didn't get that before. It's several, several weeks ago. Makes sense to me.
Therefore, you have to do it. Okay, so feedback.
And it's point about the super soul and Krishna not being involved. The next purport space.
Yeah, there's more. Because the first thing that he does in the first line of the next verse is contradict the second line in the previous verse.
Yes. also, I have a question.
Yeah.
Yes.
That's why I'm not upset. I can't explain this. because it's yoga from Aishwarya.
This one actually sets for where it says that completely understand Vishnu, you have to be in Vishnu's position.
Right. Lord Brahma saw Vishnu completely unveiled, he begged him to relieve his suffering cosmic vertigo. He begged him to, okay, enough.
Question is, I had a conversation with Lee, who's a gentleman who comes here to the temple. He had a conversation with Rama a while back. He seems to have gotten the conclusion that everything is worshipable because the super soul is present in his fullness in every act. So I'm trying to explain to him that everything isn't actually worshipable, and I quoted this verse that Krishna is everywhere.
That's the point, that he is in every, he isn't, you could say, either way you can say it, like everything is in him, but he's not in everything. You could say he is in everything, but everything is not him. It doesn't matter which way you put it. But the idea is there, that Krishna, super soul may be in a rock, but the actual, there's also the material energy, the rock, that is different from the super soul, even though he's there. And in one sense, that rock is Krishna, but in another sense, it's not. So that it's not that you can't worship anything and everything. Even though nothing is different from Krishna, from the fact that Krishna is different from everything, you cannot worship anything and everything as God. Those people will be discussed in this chapter also. Those who are not the great souls, they worship me as one without a second, diverse in me and in the universal form. That is, they worship themselves as God, they worship anything and everything as God, and they worship the universal form as God. These are the Mayavadis. They just contrast the previous verses to the Mahatmas, the great soul, the great souls. Others, he said, worship in this way. Well, Yama is very nice to say something, and I'll go back to
you. Yeah, I was going to say that this understanding of Krishna means it's kind of a conceivable. The simultaneously is, in the sense he isn't. Mm-hmm. And that Krishna in his original form, and Govardhan is not living entities. He has his agencies and material world to take care of that. But it's also Krishna.
Yeah, that also. That's a fact. Okay. Do you want to say some more?
Yeah. Pashadeya of Maheshwara. That's this. Inconceivable.
Yeah. Okay, let's go on to the next verse. Sorry, I'm going to be either cleared out or really bewildered.
Na-cha-mat-stani-bhutani
Aschane-yoga-maishwaryam
Aschane-yoga-maishwaryam
Bhuta-brinna-cha-bhuta-sto Mamatma-bhuta-bhavaha
Mamatma-bhuta-bhavaha
Na-nevacha also matstani situated in me Bhutani, all creation, pascha-jasini May my yogam aishwaryam, inconceivable mystic power, Buddha Brent, the maintainer of all living entities, na never cha also, Buddha sta in the cosmic manifestation, mama my atma self, Buddha bhava, the source of all manifestations. Translation. And yet, everything that is created does not rest in me. Behold my mystic opulence. Although I am the maintainer of all living entities, and although I am everywhere, I am not a part of this cosmic manifestation, for myself is the very source of creation. Let's read it together. And yet, everything that is created does not rest in me. Behold my mystic opulence, although I am the maintainer of all living entities, and although I am everywhere, I am not part of this cosmic manifestation, for myself is the very source of creation. So you'll see in text 4, the second line or the third line, these are, in the English, they're half lines. You know, the line is broken. So it's actually the second line, first half of the second line. Mashtani sarvutani. All living beings are in me. And this one begins, Nacha Mashtani Bhutani. All living beings are not in me. Well, it says, yet again, everything that is created does not rest in me. Right? So it's a paradox. Ashami Yoga, just see my Yogam Aishvarya, my mystic opulence. My inconceivable mystical power, Yogam Aishvarya. Srila Prabhupada's purport. The Lord says that everything is resting on Him. Mashtani Sarvabhutani. This should not be misunderstood. So now we're going to find out what this means, how it is that everything is in Him or resting on Him. The Lord is not directly concerned with the maintenance and sustenance of this material manifestation. Sometimes we see a picture of Atlas holding the globe on his shoulders. He seems to be very tired holding this great earthly planet. Such an image should not be entertained in connection with Krishna's holding this created universe. He says that although everything is resting on Him, He's aloof. The planetary systems are floating in space, and this space is the energy of the Supreme Lord, but He is different from space. He is differently situated. Therefore the Lord says, although they are situated on my inconceivable energy, as the Supreme Personality of Godhead, I am aloof from them. This is the inconceivable opulence of the Lord. You see what he's saying? He's saying, wow, he's really mixed up with everything because everything is situated on his energies. You know, he's implicated. But no, I'm aloof. I'm aloof. Prabhupada will go on to explain. In the Naruti Vedic Dictionary, it is said, Yujjate Nena Dhurgateshu Kariyeshu. The Supreme Lord is performing inconceivable, wonderful pastimes displaying His energy. His person is full of different potent energies. Oh, here's the sentence. And His determination is itself actual fact. In this way, the personality of God is to be understood. We may think of doing something, but there are so many impediments, and sometimes it is not possible to do as we like. But when Krishna wants to do something, simply by His willing, everything is performed so perfectly that one cannot imagine how it is being done. The Lord explains this fact. Although He is the maintainer and sustainer of the entire material manifestation, He does not touch this material manifestation. Simply by His supreme will, everything is created, everything is sustained, and everything is maintained, and everything is annihilated. There is no difference between His mind and Himself, as there is a difference between ourselves and our present material mind, because He is absolute spirit. Simultaneously, the Lord is present in everything, yet the common man cannot understand how He is also present personally. He is different from this material manifestation, yet as everything is resting on Him, yet everything is resting on Him. This is explained here as Yogam Aishvarya, the mystic banner of the Supreme Personality of Godhead. So, we can try to understand from Prabhupada's explanation of His absolute nature, His determination is itself an actual fact. See, so in a sense, He doesn't have to do anything. He doesn't have to do anything. It's not that he has to think of a plan and put it into action. He has to go into the material energy with wrenches and screwdrivers and everything. Yeah, fixing it up and getting it working. No, it just does it. Just what he wants. So he can remain aloof from the whole affair and it just goes the way he wants. It's so appropriate that almost it seems that the material energy just anticipates his desire. Because his desire and the facts are no different. His desire is instantly manifest as fact. It is fact. His determination is actual fact. So that's his nature. He does not touch this material manifestation. He doesn't have to get into it to maintain it and control it. So this is what he means by not directly concerned with the maintenance and substance of this material manifestation. Yet he's doing it. In that sense, he is involved. But still, the way he does it is the picture here is of Atlas, in the drawings. Of Atlas is always a strain. Always under a big strain of the earth. But Krishna has no strain whatsoever. So everything is resting in him, but you have to understand this, what this means. Everything is resting in him. Yet at the same time, it's not, in a sense, because he's never enters into the material energy, never comes into contact with the material energy, he never touches it, so to speak. So this is Yogam Aishvaryam. Aishvaryam means opulence, mystic opulence.
Lord Ananta, only supporting the universe is on his legs, and there's no Krishna in it. Krishna Loka, the only expensive.
Anybody else? Everybody understands yoga is for you.
So it's not that Krishna touches material energy, but it's expansions to it.
They don't touch it either. Which expansions? Super soul? Nope. Well, yeah, when you get into Shiva, that's when you get real close. That's why Shiva is a little bit ambiguous, because he's hanging out with dangerous energies. But what Shiva is a kind of a concretization of Krishna's glance into the material energy. He glances from a distance. He says that when Vishnu and Pragnas are living at these nature. This is action in the distance. And it doesn't come close, but they're like pencils of rays of light. And that principle of rays of light becomes manifest as Shambhu, who then becomes paired with, couples with Durga, and the material manifestation arises. But Shiva, he's really mixed up in it. But then, immediately, because he's so close, and because he consorts so intimately with these matters, mode of ignorance, he's his own tattva. He's no longer Vishnu tattva. That's why his own thing is there.
Understand how
the
super soul is not in contact with matter, because
the
super soul is inside us.
Yeah, never transcendentally situated. It's transcendentally situated. They went, when they started doing heart transplants, I learned from Prabhupada, you know, super soul and soul got transplanted too. But he's transcendentally situated.
The soul,
huh?
The soul, the ordinary soul.
Even the soul itself doesn't really. The implication of the soul in material nature is through the illusion. Matter is one thing and spirit is something else. So Krishna is the super soul and he's making all the arrangements and everything like this, but the way he does it is very, very special. He's trying to give us a hint of this, of here, of his being able to be, in the thick of it, really in the thick of it, but at the same time transcendental and aloof and not implicated. Now for us, according to our material conception, well, it's either one or the other. Either you're down here or you're in your ivory tower, but you can't be both at the same time. But Krishna pulls it off. That's because he's God. Because he's the absolute truth.
Is this somehow wrong to want to conceive this in a way? I think very mechanistically, I try to focus a full mile out of my mind, I just can't do it. Is this where we just chant and just be content with that? Or will eventually we have this knowledge?
It comes when the mind is in the transcendental position of Krishna can be understood. When we're right now we've accepted ourselves as material, so when we become free from illusion, then what's inconceivable, paradoxical, that's too materially conditioned.
I was reading a story, I think it was in Bhagavatam, where Krishna was a baby and pulled up these two trees and got these two leaves. At the time I read that, I said, it's not something. Specifically, I read it, I guess my senses are, to material sense,
You think because I haven't seen it in South Philly, it doesn't exist. It's called material conditioning.
Seen almost the stream.
Well, once he was arguing with some devotees and devotees were taking the place of material scientists, the devotees kept saying, Prabhupada, we haven't seen this, so we haven't seen Prabhupada. Said, what have you seen? He said, the inside of your mother's womb. Just sort of like wet behind the ears, nothing but the inside of your mother's womb. I don't know anything. you're hearing all about Krishna and all about the pastimes of the Supreme Personality of Godhead, the greatest person that conceivably ever exists. And then because it's amazing, you want to reject it. But if it weren't amazing, we wouldn't be dealing with God. If you want a Frank Rizzo or somebody, it's suspicion. There's no yoga mice for a gun, You'll not see any in this mayoral campaign. So don't try to reduce Krishna down to these role models of your childhood. Whoever they may be. They're not adequate. So there's no reason to reject it because it's amazing. It's all the more reason to suggest. And so the more if you read Srimad Bhagavatam, you don't know anything yet. You haven't. You have to set that ready to all dream with Bhagavatam. But it's there's the story that's told about, the story about the Suchi and the Muchi. Suchi means a Brahma. Clean means not very clean. Suchi is clean, radiant. The Brahmins are called Suchi. And the opposite is mucci, dirty. It means those people that work in leather, cobblers. It's a very degraded occupation. You have to scare the cows, you know that thing. So, geez, I don't quite remember the story. One day, Narada Muni was passing by. And he was passing by his Brahmana and asked Narada Muni where he was going. He said, "I'm going to Vaikuntha to see Lord Narayana." "Please find out, while you're there, would you inquire from him when I'm going to return back to God? Will I go at the end of this life?" "Sure." And then he meets the cobbler, also a devotee, and asks him the same question when you see Lord Narayan. Ask him when I'm going to have his eternal presence in the spiritual world. So Narada Muni got there, and he told him, "Here's this very highly elevated Brahmana. How soon before he goes back to Godhead?" "Lord Narayana said, not for many, many, many."
For him to lift up a hill or pull down two trees, it's not very easy.
Any other questions? Turn out, of course.
Yeah.
In text 4, Krishna says, Matstani Sarva Bhutani, all living beings are in me. And then, next one, text 5, he says, Nacha Matstani Bhutani. And yet again, everything is not resting in me. So we can explain this. Seemingly a contradiction. Who would say
that? When he says that everything is resting in me, it's referring to that his energies are diffused throughout creation, and everything rests on his energies, which like the total creation. And yet he still exists personally, and personally he's separate.
Okay, I guess. Which is actually pretty simple. Not so hard to understand. He's situated differently, transcendental position. There was a nice discussion about Prabhupada says Krishna's determination is itself actual fact on page 463. Determination is itself actual fact. Can you explain that? What means?
That the material world has been created by Krishna so perfectly that it pretty much works automatically even before he desires something like that.
Yeah, it just happens as soon as he responds, so it's not like he has to get involved in the creation process. Well, he does get involved, that's how he does it. He does not touch this material manifestation. It just works, kind of, by his will. It works, but he doesn't touch it. Any questions on this part? We'll go on now. Text number 6 at the bottom of the page, verse 60. We're continuing the subject.
Yatakashasthito nityam
Yatakashasthito nityam
Vayu sarvatra bhumaham
Vayu sarvatra bhumaham
Tata sarvani bhutani
Tata sarvani bhutani
Matstanit yupadharaya
Matstanit yupadharaya
Yatak just Akashas tittaha, situated in the sky. Nitya, always. Vayu, the wind. Sarvatradaha, blowing everywhere. Mahan, great. Tata, similarly. Sarvani, Bhutani, all created beings. Mashtani, situated in me. Iti, the Upadarya, trying to understand. Translation. Understand that as the mighty wind blowing everywhere rests always in the sky, all created beings rest in me. Understand that as the mighty wind blowing everywhere
rests always in the sky, all created beings rest in me.
For the ordinary person, it is almost inconceivable how the huge material creation is resting in him. But the Lord is giving an example which may help us to understand. The sky may be the biggest manifestation we can conceive. And in that sky, the wind or air is the biggest manifestation in the cosmic world. The movement of the air influences the movements of everything. But although the wind is great, it is still situated within the sky. The wind is not beyond the the sky. Similarly, all the wonderful cosmic manifestations are existing by the supreme will of God, and all of them are subordinate to that supreme will. As we generally say, not a blade of grass moves without the will of the Supreme Personality of Godhead. Thus everything is moving under His will. By His will everything is being created, everything is being maintained, and everything is being annihilated. Still, He's aloof from everything, as the sky is always aloof from the activities of the wind. In the Upanishads it is stated, yet Visha Vata Pravate, it is out of the fear of the Supreme Lord that the wind is blowing. This is the Taittiriya Upanishad 2.8.1. In the Brihat Aranyaka Upanishad 3.9.18 it is stated, Etasyava Aksharasya Prashasane Gargi Surya Chandramaso Viditra Vidhita Tishtata Etasyava Aksharasya Prashasane Gargi Vyavya Prithivyaya Vidhita Tishtata. By the Supreme Order, under the superintendence of the Supreme Personality of Godhead, the moon, the sun, and the other great planets are moving. In Brahma Samhita 5.52, it is stated, yat chakshu esha savita sakala grahana raja samasta sura murti ashesha teja yashyashnaya ramati sambhitakara chakro govindamati pushan tamaham ujjan. This is a description of the movement of the sun. It is said that the sun is considered to be one of the eyes of the Supreme Lord, and that it has immense potency to diffuse heat and light. Still, it is moving in its prescribed orbit by the order and the supreme will of Govinda. So, from the Vedic literature, we can find evidence that this material manifestation, which appears to us to be very wonderful and great, is under the complete control of the Supreme Personality of Godhead. This will be further explained in the later verses of this chapter. So, here is the example that Krishna gives to try to explain the situation of the cosmic manifestation in reference to Ganesha. Just as the wind is blowing everywhere, yet it's contained within the sky. And so all living beings, he says, rest in me. So you notice, first of all, in the purport, Prabhupada stresses that this rest in me means of being conducted at all times and in all ways under his will. Everything is happening out of fear of him. The wind blows, the sun, the moon, the stars, under his order. The sun, which is the king of the planets, eye of the Lord, goes on in its prescribed orbit, and so on. So all this is happening by the will of Krishna. But the particular thing to notice that Prabhupada brings out here, still he is aloof from everything, as the sky is always aloof from the activities of the wind. And by sky, akasha, that also refers to the element of we call space, earth, air, fire, water, ether, akasha. So that this is the subtlest of the material elements, earth, air, fire, water, ether. What's the other Sanskrit word for ether? Akash is one, and it's another one. It's another one. This case, right. Anyway, what we would call earth, air, fire, water, ether, or you could say solids, liquids, gases, radiant energy, and so on. face. I want to be more hip, if you say it like that, up to date. The idea of this akash, or the sky, or ether, is simply accommodating space, which, according to Vedic understanding, it's not a vacuum. There's a lot going on. Well, it's anyway, it's very, very subtle material element. Actually, even in modern quantum mechanics, according to Sariputta Das, scientist, he says that the quantum mechanical vacuum describes, it requires pages of formulas to describe. So it's not exactly nothing either. So anyway, that's there. And out of ether, or out of space, then comes the next element, vayu, or wind. So that's blowing around, entering into things, whipping around corners, and so on. And also, the bodies are working according to Vedic understanding by the vital forces of air working within the body. So all this is happening in space. Hurricanes, tornadoes, all these big manifestations are going on, all this weather is taking place. But the sky itself, although it's all, everything's being accommodated within, is not at all affected by this other manifestation. So everything is situated in Krishna's will. Everything happens within his will, and so this way he explains a little more what he means about all things are in me, and yet he remains at the same time. From there. Any questions? More? To the next verse. This is text number 7.
Bhakshan, although I am one, I shall become many.
This is the Vedic aphorism, Chandogya Upanishad 6.2.3. He expands himself in this material energy, and the whole cosmic manifestation again takes place. So here Krishna describes how it is ongoing. The material world is the eternal, everlasting, spiritual situation, spiritual sky. There's no creation there, neither is any annihilation. But here, in the corner of it, is this material world goes on. And so here there's this cycle of creation and destruction that takes place. And so it's on a regular basis. The Lord creates, and what happens is his energies which come out of himself, they are as he releases these energies. And under his will, then it differentiates. First it's there in the form of pada, or primordial, inchoate, undifferentiated matter. And then, by his will, the time energy enters into this matter. Then it goes through various transformations. Then false ego becomes manifested in different elements, 24 elements of creation. Gradually there's a differentiation, and material creation evolves outward, one thing after another, from subtle to gross. As the whole thing becomes displayed. And at last, for a while, here we're given the amount of time. Let's see if I can remember. 311 trillion, 4 billion years, is that right? We had in chapter 8. Is that the right figure?
311 trillion, 40 billion.
This number, 4,300,000,000, that's his one day of Brahma, his day. So a night times 2, times 30, for 30 such days and nights, times 12, for his year, times 100. That comes out to 311,000,000,040,000,000,000 years. That's how long the universe lasts. This period of creation of activity. The Lord unwinds his energies, things evolve out from them, differentiate. First it's undifferentiated material energy, and then more and more differentiation takes place where you finally end up with spiders and ants and demigods and all these bodies. The blueprints for everything is already there in the Vedas, and the prototypes for creation, the direction is there. Accordingly, everything takes place according to the directions. And then at the end, the process reverses itself and the creation winds up. And again, the energies enter back into the form of the Lord. It's described in the Bhagavatam like a spider out of his own body spins a web and sits on that web and also reabsorbs it. So in the same way, the Lord kind of his own self and produces this world, but yet it's separate. And then at the end, he takes it back inside again. And in the unmanifest state, the material energies are wound up within the Lord, although it's just a little different from it still remains the undifferentiated material energy. It's also called Brahman, by the way, later on. This material energy is also called Brahma, the great Mahan, Yoni Mahan Brahma. But it's like a little separate from him, even in that finest of wound up states. And then it goes out again. But he's always in charge of this process. So this is by his will. The thing is manifest by his will. The evolution out of the energies go to
work and out of them the different things are created, and the false ego appears, false ego and ignorance it produces, senses, sense organs, material elements, sense objects, and so on. They evolve out. It's described in the third canto and also in the second canto how this precise evolution of things takes place.
What's the difference between that total annihilation at the end of Buddha's lifetime and the partial annihilation at the end of his day?
Well, at the partial annihilation at the end of his day, the universe itself remains, and some planets also are not annihilated. He goes to sleep, and annihilation takes place up to a certain level in the universe. So it's not complete and entire. But the whole thing. But then the whole universe has to be recreated.
Right. What happens to the living entities in both annihilations?
During the night of Brahma, they're absorbed back into Garbhodaksha Vishnu. And at the end of Brahma's lifetime, then they're absorbed back into Mahavishnu. That's described as his breathing. The Lord breathes, and out of the creation, he breathes out, and all the universes and their seedling forms come pouring out of his nostrils and his skin pores. And during his period of exhalation, that's 311 trillion of our years, when he inhales, and everything is absorbed within him, and there's a completely quiescent state for another 311 trillion, 40 billion years, then he exhales again. And then within that period, there's the many universes. There's also Brahma's day and night. And in Brahma's nighttime, much of the universe is reabsorbed back into the local line of the Garbhodaksha Vishnu.
When he inhales, does it happen really quickly?
What's quick? We're dealing with 311
trillion. Just like we're in a period of exhalation now, yeah. Right? So then the period of inhalation is equally slow, so it's not as if
everything goes in all at a single instant.
Yeah.
No, but the ones that were the ones that come out first, they get absorbed last, so everybody gets an equal amount of time. Even if there's a sequence of first some universe. The universe end up floating. They describe it like bubbles. And they're clumped together like clumps of bubbles. They're little clumps of universes. And they're little shells. They have shells that are described. And so some universes are just surrounded by other universes. Others border on the Mahatattva, which is like primordial. Anyway, that's it must take some period to some must come out.
I had a couple of weeks ago I had this very terrifying dream, and what was happening, I knew what was happening in the dream. It was the Sandhya, it was one of those periods, and there was a destruction going on, and the whole world was being destroyed. And it was happening very quickly, though. Like, and I had 24 hours to try to get to the devotees. I was trying to get to the devotees, and I was telling people when I came what was going on, not to be scared, well, I mean, to try to understand what was going on. But it was like the whole earth was just falling away from my feet, and water was coming up on the land, and it was like I would have given anything to be in the spiritual world. It was just so terrifying.
Yeah, we want to avoid future experiences like that. Because it happens. I mean, we've been through these pralayas, body after body we've been through. And there's a lot of them. There's a small devastation at the end of Kali Yuga. There's a devastation at the end of every Manu, which has 14 yuga cycles in it. And there's a devastation at the end of the night of Brahma, and there's a devastation at the end of Brahma's lifetime. Plus small things like World War I, World War II, which don't count as much on the scale of things, but they're pretty rough to live through also. So this is again, we've already, Krishna says, we were reading in the last chapter, again and again this host of being is born, and again we are helplessly dissolved. And if you see a speeded up film of your life from 311 trillion, we're old. So we've been through all this stuff, and if you saw a speeded up film, you'd think, how horrible to have to live through these. These devastation, devastation. Good dream, actually.
It was the most poignant feeling I had in terms of my desire to be in the spiritual world.
Yeah, sure, because you can see at that time. See, actually, it's going on anyway, whatever. I mean, that's also a devastation, just when we lose our own bodies at the end of this life. And, everything is like, as it comes and moving the furniture out, and even taking the floor away, and the walls, nothing left. What did you got? Nothing. The whole thing has been whisked out from under you. That's the trouble, making our attachments to things in this world, because every time material nature just pulls out the rug from under us, we need to lose our own bodies and all our relationships with things. That's the nature, and that's why we read about this. We understand what is our situation.
I was wondering if you could explain the difference between the mind and the four seagulls.
Yeah. But what we call the mind is in Vedic terms a subtle mind, called subtle mind, and that has three divisions. Mind, intelligence, and false ego, according to their subtlety. So mind is that part of our interior life which just deals with growth, conditioning, and accepts and rejects things in terms of whether they're favorable or not for sense gratification, stores up memories of sense gratification, it's just where all our habits are. And then intelligence is subtler, because intelligence can redirect the mind. If you're thinking along certain habitual patterns, this is where people talk about creative thinking. Your mind tends to put you in, just get you into ruts. Certain habitual patterns of ways of doing things. And if you discover that this habitual pattern isn't, you may get some glimmering that this habitual pattern is not right. And sometimes you change it. So that facility for changing your habitual patterns is a higher power and is called intelligence, buddhi. So the mind gets fixed this way or that way, and it's fixed for sense gratification. This is the discrimination we're interested in. Either the mind is programmed or conditioned for sense gratification, or it's conditioned for spiritual life, renunciation, self-realization. But what conditions the mind, or what programs the mind, is this higher power of intelligence. It discriminates. Then even more so is the false ego, which is just the very basic error about by which we think I'm this body. By engaging in sense gratification, we acquire this false ego. My ego is my idea of myself. But the whole materialistic life is based on this false conception of a self-centered, materialistic ego. I am the enjoyer. I am the controller. It's an ego. It's a sense of myself as the center. Everything else is on the periphery. I'm the sun and all the planets rotate around me. True ego, the real ego, is I am the servant of Krishna, but the false ego is I am the enjoyer, I am the controller. Another aspect of it is I am his body. That's the false ego. That you see, we say that when we describe false ego, we describe it as we say that we think we are this body. We don't even think about it. You know, people, I never thought I am this body. Until I heard the devotees say, you think you're this body. I said, yeah, really, it's true, I do. But it's not that I ever thought it. It's just that it was just the basic, fundamental, unquestioned assumption of my existence. Or that I am the enjoyer. So it's very, 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 very deep-rooted. It goes beyond thought. It just is just a presupposition of all our thoughts. It's the whole current of which we move. So that's what false ego is.
It's kind of amazing to me, it appears that when we're trying to find the enemies, that false ego and the mind, when they get together, they're just too much to bear. How the mind, all the intelligence, is supposed to direct the mind, but how the mind can sometimes defeat even the intelligence.
Well, that's what happens, you see. Ultimately, what happens is that part of the discussion about the year, but that one, the senses become engaged in sense enjoyment, and then that influences the intelligence to become lusty. And that influences the spirit soul to acquire the false ego. So then you're being led by the senses that it means backwards. That which influences us to acquire this false ego and the enjoyer.
You know, I was thinking how humility actually is the saving grace. Even if we don't have knowledge, because if we're a little humble, then we can be submissive.
That's also saying the Bhagavad Gita. Also stated. But my, there are other people who don't have any knowledge, but they even though they have no knowledge on their own, because of their tendency to hear from authorities, because of the basic humility, they come out all right. Here, false ego, of course, that's the enemy of actual humility. Rama, did you have something?
Yeah, we're talking about Pariah devastation. In the Bible, there's a story of that devastation. They built on his ark and everything. That man was offered. Can that be speculated that some of the truth of that story is from past devastation?
Yeah. You want to speculate, you might as well speculate some Krishna consciousness. I mean, the story, you know, there is a story of an ark in the Vedas, a big boat during the Kaliyuga when the flood waters rose, and all the sages got on a boat, which was towed by a big fish. Was also saved the Vedas, they had fallen into the waters of devastation. So that's an older story. But who knows what happens to these stories, you know, in the course of, you know, crossing deserts and being passed around campfires and or whatever. I don't know what to think of that. But the big difference is these floods, like the Noah flood, these are their routine, is described at the time of devastation, the end of Brahma's lifetime. There's a cloud that Indra brings, the Samvartaka cloud. And this Samvartaka cloud is what lays down the waters of devastation, flood everybody out. That's when he saw this little boy defying its power, he decided, I'll show him. He brought in that Samvartaka cloud, which is really reserved for the devastation. He like poured it down. Just to show me, you don't want to mess with me. I'll show you. So there's a special, just there, you know, the definitely are periodic, momentous floods like that. It really messes up the geology, wipes away strata, makes it hard for everybody to figure out what was going on.
Are there descriptions of what she was part of this whole destruction process?
Yeah. I've not read anything in detail.
About his wife?
His destruction.
Involved with the
destruction. Yeah, I don't know if there's that much of
that. Like that dance.
Some dance.
You know, the kind of choreography that doesn't
drum. The hair stops.
There's a verse in the Bhagavatam. In the beginning, there is Brahma with the Japatis. In the middle, there is Vishnu and the single king. And at the end, there is Lord Shiva and the eighth is the anger. That's how it goes. Time to do another verse? Yeah. Let's do text. Any other questions about this? Suchi?
It said in that text that, I mean, in the purport that after the time when the worlds are not manifest, then it's wound up again and it comes back. And it says something like when it is needed, this happens. I can't remember the exact phrase, but
when there is a need to manifest, the cosmic world is done by His will.
Is there a variability in when that happens? What does that
mean? As far as I understand, it's regular. So the need is regular too. Like you have a need to sleep, but you know, at 9:30 or whatever. So the need is there. All those living entities wound up with their karma, waiting to open the suitcase and start trying on their clothes. But it goes like this. Actually, the description, it's like a big bang. Pradhana is like this primordial, this quantum mechanics, superheated, whatever it is that everything's supposed to come from. It sounds very much like that idea. Or even the notion that that everything comes from some primordial explosion, universe comes out and differentiates, then things start closing back in itself, get small again, and come out, and it's like a cycle. That's actually what goes on. That's actually what goes on. They'll never, of course, they can't figure out what happens if you start from the Big Bang, and nobody really can figure out where that comes from, what is it that goes bang, how it happens. But here's what really happens. But it does, it comes out just like that. Well, not just like that. There's a description of that. Well, they're dealing with mathematical abstractions. You should understand that science can deal with material nature insofar as it is describable by numbers. Or as you really abstract it from tangible sense experience. So insofar as sense experience is quantifiable, science can deal with it. But already you're abstracting a lot from reality. There's a lot of things that aren't quantifiable. So they deal, of course, then they do this other trip, which is the illegitimate part, that if it's not quantifiable, it doesn't exist. We can't deal with it. It's not important or it doesn't exist. That's just pure imperialism. There's no validity to that whatsoever. That's where you want to say, yes, and now we've got it all. It's all ours. We can understand it all. And we can grasp all knowledge by this method. That's just nonsense. This is pride. It's not science either. But anyway, so they have some inkling of this notion. Battling, breathing.
But you've made a conception that the universe is hard expanding to a certain point. And
yeah,
then
they right.
come back in.
Yeah, that's right.
So there's some correlation there between what they understand. Because they think it's a big bang.
Yeah, story. Right now it sounds reasonable that this big bang and it goes out, comes back in again. Of course, they can't figure out whether it's going to really have enough mass to collapse again or not. Maybe it's just going to just fizzle out. But sort of they get this go out, come back in, go out, come back in again, then they think, well, that solves the problem of origin because you've been going out, coming back in again. But every time anything goes out, comes back in, it goes out, comes back in, there's some little engine running, you know, it's because it's got to have some motor to keep something. That's Krishna. I mean, the ultimate idea is so simple minded, you know, it goes out and comes back in. Okay. They sound like pre-Socratic philosophers or something. Everything is one.
In that book by Carl Sagan, Cosmos describes this time period of the universe expanding and correlates it to, you know, the Vedic description of similar time periods. Mm-hmm. And he was saying, you know, it's all simply circumstantial, that there's some correlation here between these fantastic time periods of the Vedic literature's description of the universe being created and expanding.
They get impressed by these numbers, like, you know, 300,000 years. It's more like 10 years they're dealing with. So anyway, yeah, I saw some TV program where they got into that. They said,
but he just kind of like, you know, dismissed the whole thing as coincidental.
You know, little blind guys with loins lost a lot of people knowing. They have laboratories. I think that's pretty much a little bit long. Why don't we stop there? I won't pick up tomorrow and take some of the paper.